On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Curtis Franklin and Mr. Brian Chi here today. And not only is Apple back in the news because they may be secretly developing their own silicon for 5 and 6G, but we've also discussed the importance of UI design and how Citibank just got a $500 million lesson in the importance of it. Plus, in the land of DevOps, CI, and CD pipelines and keeping your services and software maintained, you may have heard of GitLab before. Well, today we have Brendan O'Leary. He's the Senior Developer Evangelist at GitLab, and we talk about just how organizations can be more efficient in their DevOps and ensuring their CI, CD loops are nothing but smooth. Shouldn't miss it. Twyatt on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 432, recorded February 26th, 2021. DevOps repository stomps bad code with baby ducks. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by the Enterprise Tech 30. Enterprise Tech 30 is a definitive list of the 30 most promising B2B startups as determined by over 100 venture capitalists and 20 corporate development teams. Visit EnterpriseTech30.com to see 2021's winners. And by Melissa. Like expired milk, 30% of your customers' data goes bad every year. That's money down the drain. Visit Melissa's developer portal for free access to data quality APIs, demos, and code samples. Freshen up your sour data today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. And by Thinks Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. For 10% off and 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. Welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through the big giant world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's a senior analyst at Omdia. Curtis, how are you doing, my friend? It seems like your house guest might not be a guest too much longer. Is that right?
Well, we've got all kinds of interesting things going on in the real estate markets here in Central Florida. So who knows what kind of news we're going to have coming out of the studio here before too long. But we're thrilled to have Chibert and Kathy here staying with us. It's making for an exciting time and lots of exciting times watching them learn the area the way we did a few years back. And in the meantime, I just keep rolling on with Omdia, researching different areas in cybersecurity, looking into all sorts of stuff in vulnerability management and enterprise security management. So lots of fun stuff to come.
Indeed, indeed. Well, speaking of fun stuff, we have one of the newest residents of the state of Florida, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, how is the house hunting coming for you?
You know, Lou, the house hunting is going great. We actually just found a property that looks really good, and we've asked our realtor to go put an offer in on it. And if all goes well, I may actually have a real street address pretty soon. But you know what? I'm also coming to you on an LTE modem. I'm going to do a shout out because Cradle, my business partner and I have been doing a lot of temporary rentals of different things. So I'm actually running on a Cradlepoint CBA 750, which is a dedicated LTE modem with high gain antennas on it. And because I'm the only one on it and I've got really, really great signal, Skype hasn't fallen flat on its face around me. So that's pretty cool. So looking forward to playing with the next generation of 5G modems once Cradlepoint is able to sell me one.
Well, speaking of busy weeks, it's been super busy in the enterprise world. Not only is Apple back in the news with the security, not only is Apple back in the news because they may be secretly developing their own silicon for 5G and 6G technologies, but we will also discuss how UI design is actually important for the overall user experience and how Citibank just got a $500 million lesson in the importance of it. Plus, in the land of DevOps and CI/CD pipelines, and keeping your services and software maintained, you may have actually heard of GitLab before. That's right. Well, today we have Brendan O'Leary. He's the Senior Developer Evangelist at GitLab, and we will talk about just how organizations can be efficient in their DevOps and ensure the CI/CD loops are nothing but smooth. But before we get into all that goodness, we have to jump into this week's news blips. Zero-day exploits can sometimes sit dormant for a long time until hackers are ready to use their magical powers. In the case of the NSA, their magical powers were exposed back in 2016 when a hacking unit called itself the Shadow Brokers announced that it had stolen malware tools and exploits used by the Equation Group, a sophisticated threat actor believed to be affiliated to the Tailored Access Operations Unit of the NSA. Although the group has since signed off following the unprecedented disclosures, new conclusive evidence unearthed by Checkpoint Research shows that this was not an isolated incident. That's right. Now, other threat actors may have used and had access to some of the same tools before they were published. The previously undocumented cyber theft took place more than 2 years before the Shadow Brokers episode. In the long report published this week, U.S. developed cyber tools reached the hands of Chinese threats and then reused them to strike American targets. The caught in the wild exploit of CVE-2017-005, a zero-day attributed by Microsoft to the Chinese APT-31, which is actually called AKA Zirconium, is in fact a replica of the Equation Group exploit codenamed ETME. Now, Checkpoint researchers say that the zero-day is a security vulnerability in the Windows component that could elevate privileges in systems running Windows XP and up to Windows 8. Checkpoint has named the clone variant Zhen. Now, Zhen has been replicated in 2014 and put in operation since at least 2015 until the underlying flaw was patched by Microsoft in 2017. Now, App31, a state-sponsored hacking collective, is claimed to conduct reconnaissance operations at the direction of the Chinese government, specializing in intellectual property theft and credential harvesting. They have had recent campaigns targeting U.S. election staff with spear phishing emails containing links that would download a Python-based implant hosted on GitHub, allowing an attacker to upload and download files as well as execute arbitrary commands. Now, even though this was caught in the wild and analyzed by Microsoft at the beginning of 2017, and even though the Shadow Brokers leak exposed Equations Group's tools almost 4 years ago, there's still a lot more we can learn by analyzing these past events. The mere fact that an entire exploitation module containing four different exploits was just lying around in unnoticed 4 years on GitHub teaches us about the size of the leak and the Equation Group's tools.
Well, Microsoft is releasing a free tool for hunting the SolarWinds malware. Organizations investigating where they're the victims of or still infected by the so-called SolarWinds attack campaign now have access to a free toolkit. It's the same one that Microsoft used to root the malware out of its own code. Microsoft is offering the CodeQL queries it employed to analyze its source code in the wake of the SolarWinds breach discovery. CodeQL is a tool in GitHub's advanced security toolset, and the queries that Microsoft used with CodeQL root out code that contains similarities in patterns and functions to the SolarWinds binary. These queries can be used on any software for signs that the SolarWinds attack has taken root. Even companies not worried about SolarWinds might want to run CodeQL because security researchers at Security Scorecard say they have discovered that one piece of malware used in the SolarWinds attacks, the memory-only dropper dubbed Teardropped, that profiled the victim's network and systems environments, dates back to 2017 and appears to be associated with a single Russian cyber espionage group. This suggests that Teardrop was likely used in other APT operations before SolarWinds by this nation-state hacking team, and that's according to Ryan Shostobatov, Vice President of Cyber Threat Research and Intelligence at Security Scorecard. His team also confirms that the attacker behind SolarWinds is a single APT group out of Russia targeting U.S. organizations. Now, like other security vendors, Security Scorecard won't name names, but many experts have surmised that all of this is the handiwork of the Russian SVR and its hacking team known as Cozy Bear.
Now, a group of business organizations led by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is suing the state of Maryland, seeking to block the implementation of the state's brand new first of its kind tax on digital advertising revenue. Now, Maryland's tax bill is, quote, deeply flawed and illegal in many ways. The suit alleges claiming that act will harm Marylanders and small businesses and reduce the overall quality of internet content. Now, this is a case of legislative overreach punishing an industry that supports over 100,000 jobs in Maryland and contributes tens of billions of dollars to its economy each year. Now, the Internet Association, one of the plaintiffs, said in the statement about the suit, now, Internet services, quote, and companies are proud to play a role in creating opportunities for Maryland's small businesses and citizens. Now, with tax revenue down across the board, states are scrambling to figure out how do they keep the coffers full. Now, telework and digital advertising seem to be favorite targets of and Maryland's attempt to seeking to make digital advertising the same as print ads, but doesn't seem to be doing a very good job on differentiating between local and out-of-state consumers, and goes on to say revenue-based scale, the act targets extraterrestrial conduct, i.e. behavior outside the state of Maryland, and is highly unusual and extraordinarily severe form of exaction. Additionally, the plaintiffs argue the tax violates the Internet Tax Freedom Act. Now, Congress first passed the ITFA in 1998 and subsequently renewed it several times before President Barack Obama signed a permanent extension of the bill into law in 2016. Now, random number generators are a valuable tool in computing. You may have used one yourself and maybe your backend systems to produce unique identifiers. They've also used to create encryption keys that scramble private data such as passwords and credit card numbers so that information can travel securely over the internet. Now, computer simulations of complex systems such as Earth's climate or the stock market also require many random numbers to properly capture chance occurrences in real life. You might know this already, but lasers can actually generate random number sequences thanks to tiny naturally occurring fluctuations in the light's frequency over time. But using a laser beam to produce random numbers like that is sort of like repeatedly rolling the single die over and over again. Now, researchers had to develop a new design to generate many strings of random digits from a single laser at once. That's right. They were able to use the chaotic fluctuations in the laser's light to translate into 4 trillion random digits per second. Light contains a constantly changing pattern of tiny pinpricks that brighten and dim randomly. When caught by high-speed cameras and light detectors, they can be translated by a computer into random series of ones and zeros. It's been a long sought-after capability to get close to truly random numbers. If they can miniaturize this new process, a mobile device near you just might have a discrete component in it which uses frickin' laser beams to generate random numbers.
Chaotic Fluctuations. Wasn't that a Moby album back in 2002? Anyway, Google and the Linux Foundation have announced plans to fund 2 full-time maintainers to exclusively focus on Linux kernel security development. Gustavo Silva and Nathan Chancellor, both active Linux contributors, will work to strengthen kernel security and associated projects. Their goal is to make the pervasive operating system more sustainable, as research indicates a need to improve open source software security, specifically in Linux. It's worth noting that Linux has more than 20,000 contributors and 1 million commits as of August 2020, but while there are thousands of Linux developers, Google's contribution to underwrite 2 full-time Linux security maintainers indicates the greater role security will play in its future. The company also hopes this initiative will motivate other organizations to contribute. Linux, which has become a bigger part of the supply chain and key enterprise systems, has also become an appealing target to advanced attackers. Strengthening the Linux kernel will be a key step in protecting open source software from both cyber criminals and advanced threats. Both Chancellor and Silva will report to David Wheeler, Director of Open Source Supply Chain Security at the Linux Foundation.
Well, the Treasury Secretary nominee Yellen is looking to curtail the use of cryptocurrency. She says cryptocurrencies could come under renewed regulatory scrutiny over the next 4 years if Janet Yellen, Joe Biden's pick to lead the Treasury Department, gets her way. During Yellen's last week Tuesday confirmation hearing before the Senate Finance Committee, Senator Maggie Hassan, Democrat of New Hampshire, asked Yellen about the use of cryptocurrency by terrorists and other criminals. Quote, "Cryptocurrencies are a particular concern," Yellen responded. "I think many are used, at least in transaction sense, mainly for illicit financing. She said she wanted to examine ways in which we can curtail their use and make sure that money laundering doesn't occur through these channels. I have agreed with nominee Yellen in the past, but on this I would like to recommend that instead the U.S. Treasury really ought to be researching cryptocurrencies themselves. The cost and anonymity of physical currency is like comparing physical keys for locks to key cards. Perhaps we ought to be at least researching alternatives to the cryptocurrencies that Yellen objects to.
Big tech has been under fire for a long time, especially for those who think that they don't actually fairly represent the everyday person. Well, in Nevada, big tech companies might have just been leveled up by the state government and have been given legendary powers of the government themselves. That's right. Nevada Governor Steve Sisolak will be announcing new legislation that will allow major technology companies to effectively form techno-governments. Now, that's the nuts and bolts of the legislation is essentially creating innovation zones in Nevada. New companies creating groundbreaking technologies come to Nevada to develop their industries. Now, this will be done without actually any tax abatements or public financing. But instead, a major technology firm would be granted the authority to form their own independent techno-governments within Nevada. They would carry the same authority as a county, including imposing taxes, forming school districts and justice courts, and providing government services, to name a few duties. Now, the government and the governor specifically mentioned that the company Blockchains LLC has already been committed to creating a techno-government in the state that would, quote, fully run on blockchain technology. They're ready, too, because according to the state records, Blockchain purchased 67,125 acres of uninhabited land at the Tahoe-Reno Industrial Center for $170 million. Now, records also show the company's owner, Jeffrey Burns, personally gave $50,000 to the Nevada Democratic Party in 2019 and various donations ranging from $1,000 to $5,000 to various state lawmakers from both parties. It looks like it may be true that money might just be able to buy just about everything. Well, folks, that does it for this week's Blips. But next up, we have the Bites. But before we get to the Bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is the Enterprise Tech 30. The Enterprise Tech 30 is a piece of seminal research developed by Wing Venture Capital in partnership with NASDAQ. The private enterprise tech is an opaque sector. You have no idea which company is doing well or poorly due to companies being sneaky around growth and revenue, especially as sales cycles can be long and arduous. Now, many ranked lists feature startups or tech disruptors. Now, these lists are often dominated by consumer brands or more mature B2B startups everyone already knows. Now, these lists create credibility and trust that a company featured will deliver a real, tangible outcome. However, this is often not the case because many of these lists are produced by lobbying or pay-to-play methods and are subject to bias based on how much hype a company can generate. Now, the Enterprise Tech 30 brings to light the enterprise startups who have the most potential to essentially shift how enterprises operate for the better. Now, beneficiaries to the ET30 are on a fast track of growth, change how business is done, and are expected to be future IPOs and multi-billion dollar exits. It's impossible to lobby your way onto the ET30. In fact, you can only be selected to become a part of the elite community. The Enterprise 30 focuses on companies with a potential at all stages of maturity rather than only showcasing companies with mature businesses and undeniable traction. The ET30 should be considered a buying guide for enterprise executives seeking to bring more validated and credible digital innovation into their organizations. Enterprise tech founders should see inclusion as the highest endorsement of their current and future success. Founders that seek to build publicly traded companies should see inclusion as a watershed moment in their founder's journey. Tech executives and high performance operators will use the list to help guide their decisions on what companies to join. The 2021 edition of the Enterprise Tech 30, brought to you by Wing Venture Capital and NASDAQ, just launched. Head over to enterprisetech30.com to see who made this year's list. That's enterprisetech30.com. And we thank ET30, Wing, and NASDAQ for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the Bites. We have a couple good ones today. Now, you know, with online crawlers, online web crawlers lurking around in all corners of the internet, can be challenging for corporations to search for industry experts covertly, because a company might need to get an expert in that, you know, for a new technology they're trying to develop, and you know, a lot of people out there will find out if they post it publicly. Now, in the case of Apple, the latest job posting may have let the cat out of the bag about their search for 5G and 6G wireless systems engineers that may have given light to the fact that Apple is already working on developing 6G wireless technology and has still in many years, but still might be many years away. But Apple doesn't want to depend on Qualcomm anymore here. The job listing is for a wireless research systems engineer, 5G and 6G, and RAN 1 and RAN 5 standards engineer. The listings have statements like, you will be part of a team defining the doing research of next generation standards like 6G. You will research and design next generation 6G wireless communication systems for radio access networks with emphasis on the PHY and MAC L2 and L3 layers. Participate in the industry academic forums passionate about 6G technology and contribute to future 3GPP RAN work items on 6G technology. Now, Apple first introduced its first 5G phones and iPhone 12 lineup last year, and those phones use Qualcomm modems. But recent reports have already revealed that Apple plans to design its own modems to drop the Qualcomm components from future phones, just as it's been developing its own silicon for Macs now to ultimately replace Intel chips and most of its product lines. Now, total end-to-end integration of all the parts of the hardware and software and services and devices has long been both a key marketing point and an internal guiding principle for product development at Apple. We all know this. Now, the company says it believes this approach enables better products and experiences for users. Still, it also gives Apple the ability to forge ahead with less dependence on other actors to achieve its success. Now, Apple recently joined the industry group NextG Alliance with other companies like LG, Google to work together to define the specifications for 6G, which is still in its infant stages and not expected to actually reach consumers for many years yet. Now, there are no details yet about either their timeline, specifications, or features of 6G, but 5G is only just rolling out in the past couple of years. Now, the vast majority of globe does not yet have access to 5G just yet. Okay, I want to bring my co-host in. This is interesting. Obviously, we've seen Apple starting to go down this route again. They were in this route when they first started out. They were on very specialized hardware. They were on very specialized software, and then they went to more generic, and that actually got them to be more popular. And now they're at the critical mass of being popular, and they want to become more reliant on their own technology again. So that it makes sense. The question is, will that force the standards to fork? What do you think, Cheaper?
I think a lot of things need to change. Obviously, there's been a lot of frustration in the Apple camp with what Qualcomm has and has not done for them over the years. One thing I need to remind a lot of people about is that RF design might as well be black magic, and we call the person Gandalf. There's a lot of things that have to happen, and one of the things that people also forget is that when we start going into 5G and now they're talking 6G, we're talking about smaller and smaller microcells all over the place, and the legislation hasn't caught up yet. So there's going to be some things that need to change, and my big question is Apple a big enough gorilla to be able to go and wrangle the legislators of different states and counties and places like that? Because they're going to need to go and push on the microcells, because the chips in the devices are only a small portion of the overall overall solution. 5G is just barely out. Kurt just got a 5G modem for his house, and right now the speed is no better than LTE. That will change, especially at the end of this year, because 3G gets officially turned off, and the bands that 3G are sitting on currently are going to be given over to the 5G world. That same kind of process is going to have to happen for 6G. So there's going to be changes. There's going to be a lot of new technology that's going to have to be developed, and there's going to be a lot of new legislation. So don't go starting looking for a 6G modem yet. the 5G modems aren't even fully baked yet.
Right, right. Curtis, I mean, I want to throw this to you because T-Bert brought it up. I mean, Apple has a large amount of market share. It feels like they're trying to dictate stuff here. It feels like they're trying to develop a set of technology that matches their needs and their quote, customers' needs. But again, with Qualcomm has to do it in a more generic solution to make a lot of customers happy with their chips. You know, Apple only has to make their own customers happy in their own devices and their own implementation of a happy. Is this a bad move for Apple? Will this change the market? What do you think?
Well, I don't think it's a bad move for Apple, because if they do want to have any sort of input in what 6G will look like, now's the time to do it, because 6G is officially undefined. I mean, completely undefined. There is no ITU working committee on it right now. It exists in the same way that Apple could put out a job posting saying that they were looking for people to help in their sparkly unicorn breeding program. I mean, this would have about the same level of today tangible effect. With that said, we have seen many other organizations in the past take similar routes, including, we have to note, the one, Lou, that you work for. Microsoft has had representatives on any number of standard committees over the years, sometimes with the aim of making the overall standard stronger, sometimes with the aim of making the overall standard friendlier to particular technologies. All companies do this. Apple is no different. And I think it is going to be interesting. Apple is now effectively the world's largest handset vendor, to see how they are able to shape this. And they have there are a lot of politics that are going to end up being involved in this. Right now, because of the IC chip shortage that's affecting many industries, we're seeing the U.S. government start to make strong overtures to companies to move foundries and the supporting industries back to the U.S. They like the idea that Apple would be involved in designing the next generation. We also have China, which has put up a satellite that they claim is the first 6G communication satellite, albeit in a test configuration. Fascinating, because as I said, 6G is entirely undefined. So this is a reasonable thing for a very forward-looking company to do. The surprising thing would be if more companies weren't doing it. I strongly suspect that while they may not have advertised quite so blatantly, there are any number of companies that have quietly been hiring good, solid wireless engineers, hoping to be able to get a leg up on the competition when it comes to defining 6G.
Right. Agreed. I think Apple, if done right, I think that they will definitely be able to at least come out with something that will be adopted. No question is whether it will fork the standard and fork the technology is yet to be seen. We'll see. Well, folks, we have another great bite. But before we get to that bite, we have to thank another great sponsor of this week in enterprise tech, and that's Melissa. Now, have you ever forgotten to check the date on a carton of milk? I know I have, and it's easy to store it away and just forget about it. And like milk, your customer data can also go bad, sometimes even faster than milk. And to put it in perspective, up to 30% of customer data goes bad each and every year. Now, think about your customer base. That's a lot of customers. That's when Melissa is there for you. Melissa makes sure your data is accurate and current so you can reach the right customers. Their tools have helped businesses maintain fresh data for over 30 years. Don't throw money down the drain with bad data. Think about how valuable it could be if your organization could verify addresses, emails, phone numbers, and names in real time with Melissa. Melissa's global address verification service verifies addresses for over 240 countries and territories at the point of entry. This ensures that only valid billing and shipping addresses are captured and used in your systems. In fact, you can identify your customers and get to know them, add customer demographic information to your records such as property and mortgage data, even marital status or social media handles. Melissa's APIs are top-notch. Now, as a developer like me, I can definitely tell you I've used them, and it's really easy to integrate into any process. Now, Melissa's flexible deployment options offer different platforms to suit any preference, in fact, even business size or budget. With flexible on-premise web service, secure FTP processing, and software as a service deliver options, you can choose the best way to meet your unique business needs. Melissa continually undergoes independent security audits to reinforce their commitment to data security, privacy, and compliance requirements. They have the utmost dedication to your data security by implementing strong controls and safeguards when processing your data. In fact, they're SOC 2, HIPAA, and GDPR compliant. Over 10,000 businesses trust the address experts. Melissa's supporting communities and qualifying essential workers during COVID-19. See if your organization qualifies for 6 months of free service by applying. Don't put up with sour customer data. Try Melissa's APIs in the developer portal. It's easy to log on, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox 24/7. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. That's melissa.com/twit. And we thank Melissa for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, let's get to the next bite, because the next bite is pretty interesting. I work with a lot of user experience researchers around developing UIs for new software. I work for the office team, so I can definitely tell you there's lots of designing and redesigning and, always looking at how customers are experiencing things. It's important. It's really, really important for the overall user experience. Well, it looks like Citibank just got a $500 million lesson in the importance of UI design. Take it away, Jibert.
Well, in this case, the story goes, Citibank has a $500 million lesson in UI. Basically, let's summarize this. Citibank was acting as an agent for companies like Revlon, which owed hundreds of millions of dollars to various creditors. On August 11th of this year, Citibank was supposed to send out interest payments totaling $7.8 million to these particular creditors. However, Revlon was in the process of refinancing its debt, paying off a few creditors while rolling the rest of its debt into a new loan. And this, combined with the confusing interface of financial software called FlexCube, led the bank to accidentally pay back the principal on the entire loan, most of which wasn't due until 2023. So this is how Judge Jesse Furman describes the whole situation. On FlexCube, the easiest or perhaps the only way to execute the transaction to pay the Angelo Gordon lenders their share of the principal and interim interest owed as of August 11, 2020, and then to reconstitute the 2016 term loan with the remaining lenders was to enter it in the system as if paying off the loan in its entirety, thereby triggering accrued interest payments to all lenders, but to direct the principal portion of the payment to a, quote, wash account, quote, an internal Citibank account, quote, to help ensure the money does not leave the bank. Well, the actual work of entering the transaction into FlexCube fell to a subcontractor in India. He was presented with a FlexCube screen that looked kind of like this. And if you could bring up the URL from the story, it is probably an example of one of the worst user interfaces I have ever seen. So the subcontractor thought that the checking the principal checkbox and entering the number of a Citibank wash account would ensure that the principal payment would stay at Citibank. He was wrong. To prevent payment of the principal, the subcontractor actually needed to set the, quote, front and fund fields to the wash account as well as the principal. The subcontractor didn't do that. Anyway, it's boy, oh boy, what a mess. And when you get a chance, bring up that user interface and really take a good hard look at it. It reminds me of some of the user interfaces from way, way, way back in the IBM, you know, mainframe world. If you've ever seen the interface for Sabre, Sabre was an airline reservation system that was so bad. Some of the horror stories are that people got hit by, you know, on one hand, some people got free or nearly free flights. Some people got booked on five different flights instead of a round trip. It was a mess. The airlines had to go and redesign it so that less mistakes were made. It looks like Citibank never learned that lesson. So anyway, Lou, you're Mr. User Interface. I'm not sure. Are you even old enough to have remembered those old mainframe green screens and how horrible those interfaces were? What other lessons have we learned over the years? You know, it's time for a soapbox, dude. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, I do remember the IBM AIX interfaces. I used to work with those when I was at Anheuser-Busch. So I definitely remember that. And they had some complexity to them. You know, it's one of those things. Like, organizations, they go through these, these kind of roller coasters with user experience. They try to put out something that has some value, their MVP, and then they go through and find out, oh, wait, like, we are preventing some users that we thought, that we thought could just use our system, and they can't. And so I definitely can tell you that organizations will learn from their mistakes, and they usually do iterate on things. And I can honestly say, I used to work on an ERP, enterprise resources planning product, financials product, called Great Plains back in the day when I first started at Microsoft. And I can tell you that the interface looked like that. So Sabre wasn't its only player in that type of interface, because any type of financials, like, for instance, UltraTax was another piece of software I worked back in the day. Again, their interface was the same. So any type of data entry interface, organizations didn't really know how that was supposed to look. And so, in fact, my team also develops Microsoft Access today. And even some of their controls are actually more advanced and easier to use than some of the applications that were built back in the day. So it's a really important thing. Like, I think organizations should think about, when they're developing software, that things need to be clear. It needs to be things need to be get the user interface needs to get out of the way, so that people entering data or need to understand what they're actually entering and where the data is going to go, and when they have access to it. I mean, a lot of even websites and services today have this problem. In fact, the other day I was entering a form for something, and I was watching as I was entering, and I noticed that it was a click next type thing. And I was like, oh, what did I enter? I have to go back. And I'd click next back, and I would lose data, or the cache would flock, would be cleared. Or it was just a really horrible, horrible design. And so companies just haven't learned. So I'm hoping that over time, companies like Citibank, Bloomberg, all these different companies out there will figure out that their customers need ease of use and they should pay more attention to UX.
Yeah. So I'm going to bring this conversation up to modern days. It is a conversation, an argument I've had with many, many, many of my students and peers in my industry. It's that whole command line versus GUI argument that is probably never, ever going to be solved. Now, I should point out that Judge Furman is telling Citibank, no soap, bub. You're going to eat that. But Citibank is definitely going to go back, and they're going to disagree with this, and they're going to try and pursue recovery anyway. So, Kurt, the argument keeps going. Command line is great because we can stack a whole bunch of things, and it's super efficient. And that was the argument that a lot of the airlines used about Sabre, because, wow, I can do a whole bunch of commands on a single command line. And when I hit enter, it goes. And it was really great when we had really, really slow connections. But the GUI means maybe less errors. So in your experience, why don't you throw some gasoline on the fire of command line versus GUI and things like that?
Well, I think the real question is figuring out where the most expensive part of the system is. Back when Sabre was doing its thing, the comlinks and the mainframes that Sabre ran on, their CPU time, were the most expensive parts of the process. It was worth requiring the humans to learn a greater command competency, to demonstrate additional learning, to remember more or write it down and put it on a piece of paper next to the terminal in order to maximize the value of those very expensive components. Today, that has flipped around. What's the most expensive part of most of these systems? The time of the human beings who are working on them. And that's why the GUI interface has become so important, because it allows people with minimal training to conduct transactions. We figure that the systems are fast enough to make up for any delay in interpreting all those graphical images, and the pipes are big enough that they're not going to choke on all of the data flowing back and forth to support those images. So this is all to maximize human time. That's great until one of the pieces of hardware or software chokes. And that's when we find out that, like so many pieces of the supply chain that we've been dealing with in the past year or so, we have a supply chain that is amazingly efficient, incredibly effective, and astoundingly, devastatingly brittle. And so that's what we had in this case. You know, a system that was designed to allow individuals, bank clerks by any other name, to take care of these transactions, send them on their way. But when it breaks ugly.
Well, you know, I don't think this conversation is ever going to be over. And hey, Citibank, you guys know how to do user interfaces, but apparently that effort isn't worth your subcontractors who may or may not have had the right training. Think about that the next time you have to do an annual report. Well, we've got a story about Mobile World Congress, and they're going to proceed without requiring vaccines, the COVID-19 vaccine. And while some people are saying that's really crazy, maybe we need to compare it to what's happening now with international travel in general. So within almost all the airlines in America, you have to have a negative COVID-19 test. It has to be one of the, I think it's called a PCR test, the one where they swab the inside of your nostril. It can't be the spit test because they want the higher reliability. So within 72 hours of travel, that's what you have to have if you're coming from outside the U.S. into the United States. So this has become the gold standard for traveling international. Well, in this case, what they're going to do is for Mobile World Congress, they're saying attendees must test negative for COVID-19 within 72 hours of the event with testing available on site. Further, the event's organizers claim that we'll use some form of technology to create a touchless environment at the event, which is often at least partially focusing on handling smartphones and other devices with touchscreens. Going to be really interesting. Now, I should point out Mobile World Congress is a massive event. Our friend Padre normally loves to go to this because it gives you a huge insight into what's going to happen within the whole mobile world. Anyway, so some of the things that are happening are going to be talking about what's going on with 5G. Keep in mind, 5G isn't completely baked yet. It's really close, but it's not set in stone. So a lot of things, a lot of these conversations are actually happening at places like Mobile World Congress. So, Curtis, you work for a company that's going to start looking at in-person conventions someday in the near future. Is this unexpected, or is this something that you've seen coming down the tracks at you?
Just to let everyone know, the company that owns Omdia is Informa. Informa is the world's largest producer of trade shows and conferences. So obviously this issue is one that's of critical importance to the company. And I have watched an awful lot of conversation go on from the CEO down about when in-person events can take place, should take place. The answer is not straightforward. It is strongly, it depends. For example, I know that our company is currently easing back into in-person events in Asia. And we have had a couple of in-person events here in the U.S. The Fort Lauderdale In the Water Boat Show, for example, is produced by Informa, and that took place within the last 2 or 3 months, though it has to be stated that that is an outdoor event where spacing people out is fairly easy. The real question about an event like MWC, when it comes to doing in-person events, isn't, from an economic standpoint, whether it's safe. You're not so much worried about whether you're going to be sued. It's whether attendees will feel safe enough to come, and whether vendors, exhibitors, will feel safe enough to send a staff for their booths. If the answer to both of those questions is yes, in sufficient numbers, then you want to have those in-person events happening as quickly as possible, because they're much more profitable than the virtual events. On the other hand, there's no point in putting on an in-person event if no one's going to come. So I personally think that going into Europe, that MWC is perhaps jumping the gun a bit. But I don't have their research to look at. I think that every other European and North American trade show and conference producer is going to be watching them very, very closely to see what happens. Obviously, this is one of those cases where someone has to be first, and we'll find out just how many arrows they're going to get in their back for being the pioneer.
Well, I'll tell you, only time will tell, and here's hoping these vaccines work and keep working. But you know what? We actually kind of did this because our guest was having a little technical difficulties, but he's back. And I'm going to toss this back to Lou, and maybe what we should do is we should do an ad and then bring our guest in. What do you think, Lou?
Sounds good. Sounds good. Well, next up, we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Ride. Before we get to that, we do have to thank another great sponsor of this week in enterprise tech, and that's Thinkst Canary. The last thing anyone wants or needs right now is a data breach. Rather than the villain lying in wait, you have a hero. That's Thinkst Canary, and that's wait. They're waiting for them. Now, companies usually find out too late that they've been compromised. Even after they've already spent millions on IT security, it wasn't enough. Canary has completely changed the game. It's designed to be installed and configured in minutes, and pardon the pun, left to its own devices. You don't have to think about it. Now, attackers prowling a target network look for juicy content. They'll browse Active Directory for file servers and explore file shares looking for documents. Now, they'll try the default passwords against network devices and web services, and they will also scan for open services across the network. Now, Canary can be deployed throughout your entire network, and you can make them look identical. to a router, a switch, a NAS server, a Linux box, or a Windows server, so attackers won't know they've been caught. Now, things canaries are designed to look like the things the hackers want to get to. Now, you could put fake files on them or enroll them in Active Directory. Now, when attackers investigate further, they give themselves away and you're instantly notified. Now, you can also use canary tokens. These are tiny tripwires you can drop into hundreds of places. They follow the Thinks Canary philosophy of trivial to deploy with a ridiculously high quality of signal. Now, if an alert happens, Canary will notify you the way you want. Plus, you won't be inundated with false alarms. Get alerts by either email or text message on your console, Slack, webhooks, syslogs, or their API. Choose the option that works best for your business. It's important that companies know two things when it comes to data breaches. One, hackers will usually take the path of least resistance, and that's typically your staff. And two, it takes an average 191 days for a company to realize there's been a data breach. Now, that's too long, and Things Canary solves that problem for you. Now, the people behind Canary have been in the security game for almost two decades and have trained companies, militaries, and governments on how to break into networks. That's the knowledge they've used to build Canary. Now, Things Canary are deployed all over the world on all seven continents and are one of the best tools against data breaches. Visit canary.tools/twit, and for just $7,500 per year, you'll get five canaries, your own hosted console, upgrades, support, and maintenance. And if you use code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box, you'll get 10% off the price for life. We know you'll love Things Canary, but if you're not happy, you can always return your canaries with their 2-month money back guarantee for a full refund. That's canary.tools/twit, and enter the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. And we thank Things Canary for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today we have Mr. Brendan O'Leary. He's the Senior Developer Evangelist for GitLab. Welcome to the show, Brendan.
Hey, Lou. Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Can you maybe take us through just a short journey through tech and what brought you to GitLab?
Sure. Yeah. Quickly, I kind of started in your traditional IT, break fix, you know, that kind of stuff, setting up servers, Windows NT 4.0, you know, to give you a little date myself. Then I got into software, spent time in medical software, some time in the defense contracting space, and I was a GitLab user there and ended up, you know, kind of falling in love with the company and deciding to try and join. And I joined in 2017 when we were about 150 people. And since then, we've grown to over 1,300 people in 65 different countries and regions because we have zero offices. We've been all remote before it was required by the pandemic.
Wow, wow. Yeah, I think it's interesting because, you know, I've used GitLab before and, you know, and in fact, they were the first ones to do a lot of the free stuff. I know that, you know, GitHub's been around, but, you know, they've had some restrictions and, you know, GitLab was one that came in and was doing it for free quite often. So there was a lot of critical mass that happened there on that platform. And I can honestly say that I put myself on there and have several projects that I host from there. So I'm sure that our audience knows a lot about GitLab. Can you maybe just take us through a quick summary of what GitLab is and what it offers?
Sure, sure. Well, like you, Lou, the freeness is what brought me there at first, too. Mm-hmm. I had a side project that was making exactly $0, and I was paying for repository hosting on GitHub. And so I went to GitLab originally to get away from having to pay for my Git repositories. Now, that's kind of a ubiquitous thing. But at the time, like you said, GitLab was the one doing it. And the other thing I discovered there actually tells you a lot about what GitLab does is I, again, wasn't making a lot of money on this thing, had a good number of users, and needed to be able to kind of feed and water and maintain it. That's where I found GitLab CI, CD. And I actually ended up orchestrating the pipeline so that I could just, in the web IDE in GitLab, make a change and have it deploy. And that's really where GitLab had kind of set itself apart in the market and what it kind of evolved to today. Of course, it started with, you know, source code management, repositories, right? Gits in the name. But now it's a complete DevOps platform, kind of from start to finish. So there's planning capabilities. There's, of course, the code management capabilities and review capabilities. There's the ability to also do CI/CD and integrate security into that pipeline. So now it kind of has all of that in one single platform as a single application. And that's really what GitLab is today.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing the amount of things that GitLab and some of these other services integrate into. You know, a lot of teams out there, they're always looking for solutions. What is the one thing that GitLab can do that will help them? Does it help provide them with the appropriate solutions to help them with some of their troubles there, especially around DevOps and CI/CD stuff?
Yeah, I think that's it, right? I mean, folks, the more, GitLab, again, you can adopt more or less of the platform, but the more of the platform you adopt, the less other tools you have to stitch together and, integrate and spend time and money and effort maintaining. And so GitLab can be anything from just your code repository to being, your entire DevOps stack, right, from start to finish. And so we see as folks adopt more and more of those various stages that we saw, they get more benefit from the application because we don't really charge for the entire DevOps lifecycle. There's features even in our open source version through that entire lifecycle. But the more that you're able to adopt, a single platform, the faster you're able to ship code into production, the faster you're able to iterate on your code. And as we all know, that's how we're delivering value to our customers as enterprises. And so that's really critical.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things, I mean, obviously these source repositories, especially ones in their cloud, they're very useful for teams, especially distributed ones. And they can be very easy to sit back and let them kind of take control sometimes. And obviously we've seen recently some of the supply chain attacks that have happened out there in the wild. What are some of the things that GitLab is doing to help with that?
Yeah, no, it's really critical. And I've actually been talking a lot about those supply chain attacks and how we can think of security as an entire supply chain. I think it's really important to have security. We've been talking about shifting security left and all these various things. I think we're actually probably past that point now. And now we're at the point where if you're not doing security as an integrated part of your CI/CD pipeline, you're already behind. And when we say security, it's multifaceted, right? It's of course, static code analysis, but it's also dynamic code analysis. It's dependency management. It's understanding, let's say there's a vulnerability discovered somewhere in a open source dependency tomorrow. Do you know everywhere in your stack that dependency is? That's a really critical thing. We see more and more folks having known vulnerabilities that sit in production systems for a very long time. And so having security, it's something that we've been focused heavily on for the past couple of years, is bringing all of those security tools directly into GitLab as part of the CI/CD pipeline, I think is really critical.
Right. Well, I did want to bring my co-host back in. Let's start with you, Chibert.
Okay, I'm an academic. I used to provide support to the computer science department at the University of Hawaii, and it's been burning into my back of the mind. What drove the creation of, GitLabs in general, and of course GitHub? What was behind all that?
That's a really great question, Brian. And it's interesting because, of course there's Git, which we share with GitHub, right? So that is the open source distributed, way of doing source code management, and that came out of, famously Linus Torvald in a weekend. Writing Git because the tool that they were using for the Linux kernel at the time was actually, I think it was called BitKeeper. And it was, they had like a license that they were letting the Linux kernel use, but that license was going to get revoked or they were going to take pieces away from him. And so he decided to write his own source code management tool in a weekend. And so then the Linux kernel adopted Git and Git started to become a lot more popular because at the time, we had all these centralized source code management systems. So a lot of us will remember SVN and CVS and, some of these other systems that require developers to have a direct connection to the server in order to do their development, whereas Git allows you to have an entire copy of the repository on your local machine, and then, you know, be able to then, you know, make changes that are either offline and then push them back up. So GitHub and GitLab came from, well, this distributed source code is great. It works really great for the Linux Foundation. They love, you know, using mail services to push around changes. But in the enterprise, right, and in open source for folks that aren't quite as sophisticated as that, it's easier to have a centralized server where we can then collaborate on those code changes directly. And so that's where GitHub and GitLab came from. So GitHub came first, to be fair to it. And then GitLab came because our co-founder, Dmitry, he was living in the – well, he still lives in Ukraine, and he had two problems. He didn't have running water at home. He had to go to a well and walk his water to his house every day. And he didn't have the ability to use GitHub or use any collaboration software at work. And if you hear Sid, our CEO, the other co-founder, talk, he says, oh, he solved the most important problem first, and he wrote GitLab. And so actually DZ wrote it, you know, as this need to, you know, have a piece of software to collaborate with, his to other developers. And that's what got Sid, our other co-founder, who's originally from the Netherlands, really interested in it, is he said, hey, it really makes a lot of sense if developers are going to be collaborating on a tool, for that tool to also be open source so that they can, you know, add their ideas and collaborate on the tool itself. And that's how GitLab came about.
Well, thank you so very much. I've been dying. One of my students was Warren Togami, and he was the gentleman behind the Fedora distro. And he introduced me to this really, you know, in those days, new thing called GitHub. It's like, wow. Mm-hmm. And it's become ubiquitous now. But you know what? We need to shift gears. Kurt's more on the enterprise side. Let's go toss it to Kurt and see what kinds of enterprise goodness he can share with us.
Well, I appreciate it. And coming from my particular angle, one of the things I want to talk about is GitHub, GitLabs, and security. You know, there have been some notable cases, not tons, but some notable cases of people either keeping malware in a Git repository, people uploading infected components. So in response, we have tools that allow you to scan components for malware, to do some reliable, you know, static checking, to do all kinds of things while it's in the repository. So I guess one of my questions to you is, how much should a repository do to ensure the security, stability, reliability of the code within the projects? Or should a repository like Git logically be absolutely agnostic? You know, put up your code, whatever, you know. If your code goes out and stomps baby ducks, that's fine with us. Code is code. What's the right take on that?
That's a great question. And yeah, I think it's been, you know, something that's been changing, especially as Git has become, you know, this ubiquitous way that we collaborate on code, right? And so it's become like there's not really a lot of use. I mean, there are other source code tools that exist, but really Git is kind of the universal source code tool we're using now. And as that's come to be, and as, you know, like I said, GitLab kind of focused on a wider look at the entire DevOps lifecycle, I think it's become very clear both from that and from, you know, the universal acceptance that, hey, we're going to have a lot of open source libraries in whatever software we're writing. And we're going to be pulling those in, whether it's, you know, from the NPM registry or from Maven registries. You know, we're going to have software that is part what our enterprise has written and part what someone else has written, because we're bringing in the best of open source. So those two things converging lead to exactly what you're talking about, Kurt, which is, you know, how can we make sure that that code that we're writing and consuming is secure? And that's why we're seeing this huge consolidation in industry where both GitHub and GitLab are looking at, and others are looking at, you know, the entire DevOps platform and not just source code management, but what happens after, you know, we've committed our code. How do we ensure that that code is going to be secure? How do we know that the dependencies we're bringing into our environments, right, are secure? How do we know just what those dependencies are, right? The concept of a digital bill of materials, right? These kinds of things that we talk about in typical industrial supply chain management are really just as critical now for us as software supply chain managers. And this is something that enterprises everywhere are struggling with, and why we've seen, you know, a huge influx of users and our enterprise users focused on those security tools. And like you said, it's not just static code analysis, it's dependency analysis. It's, as we move with containers, it's container analysis. You know, containers, for those that don't know exactly how those are composed, you know, there's many layers that make up those containers. So we should scan each of those layers and understand what's in them, right? So as we're bringing in all of these dependencies that are both inside and outside our enterprises, we have to understand where those are coming in, and if there's a vulnerability in them, how we can mitigate that.
Well, you know, one of the things you were talking about, you mentioned containers in your answer there. Mm-hmm. And Git has been seen as valuable by all kinds of people wanting to share all kinds of things. It's become far more than simply a code repository for people working on a software development project together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wanted to talk to you about that. How does Git feel about this as an organization? Because I have seen it being used for everything from game designers sharing worlds and scenarios that they're building to people sharing pieces of books, pieces of other creative output. And it really has become sort of an online portfolio for mm-hmm. many individuals who are either selling or trying to convince the world that they're good at what they do. You know, where does Git sit as a general information repository rather than just a code repository?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's two answers, right? There's the philosophical answer and then the technical answer. I think philosophically, we fall very solidly on the side that it is the where all information will live eventually. We have our mission at GitLab is everyone can contribute. We believe that Git and the technologies that are around it can enable everything in the world to move from read-only to read-write. We think that everyone can contribute. We, you know, have our roots in open source. It is an open source tool, right? We're an open core company. So we very much believe in that. And Git is fantastic at managing text. And so to your point, like any kind of creative text, it's a great tool to enable folks to collaborate on that. I know there's even a publishing company that's taken GitLab because you know, it's open source, and turned it into a tool that they use in their publishing pipelines for book publishing. Now, when it comes to game design, I think there's the technical side too, which is Git is fantastic at managing text files. But if you're talking about game design, now you're talking about things that aren't text, right? You're talking about massive images or other binary kind of data that we need to manage as well. And so there's a lot of different ways that Git is looking at addressing that. You know, there's things like partial clones and Git LFS, ways of managing large volumes of data that may be binary in nature, right? And that's, again, for those game designers or other kinds of creative endeavors that require this, you know, massive binary or, you know, non-text-based kind of data and collaboration on that. And so I think we're going to see more and more of that in the coming years. When it comes to other binary data, right, the stuff we think of as programmers, like, you know, your jar file that comes out or your container that comes out of your code, that I think is also important. That's why we have built in, not to Git, but into GitLab, an artifact repository that is separate from Git, but allows kind of for all of that artifact management. And so, again, once you get technical, I can go off in any tangent there. But I think conceptually, exactly what you're talking about is correct, which is, you know, Git enables creative knowledge workers of all kinds to collaborate and contribute.
Well, folks, all good things come to an end, unfortunately. Brendan, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little bit low on time, but I did want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where they can learn more about GitLab and maybe how they can get started.
Sure, yeah. If you visit about.gitlab.com, you can sign up for a free account. Like Lou and I said, there's a lot that you can do with that. You can also start a free trial of our enterprise product if you're looking for that. And yeah, we've got lots of documentation. Entire company is actually kind of open sourced. Our handbook, how we run the company, is all available on that website as well. And it's Creative Commons licensed, so you can actually fork the company if you want to. So if it exists, it'll be out there and you can find it on GitLab.
Fantastic. Thank you, Brendan. Yeah, there was actually a really great remote work post by GitLab recently, too. Check that out. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best staying enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your podcaster to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. It's definitely a team effort. We have the best team on the market, especially my co-host, starting with Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, what's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you and get a hold of you online?
Well, I am ADVNETLAB on Twitter, but I'm also Chebert, spelled Cheebert, at twit.tv. But you know what? Why don't you send it to twyatt@twit.tv, and that'll hit all the hosts. Now, I'm going to fess up. I missed my first blip because I was rushing back from a showing of a new house here in Orlando, Florida, which we like good enough. We're working on putting an offer in a little bit above asking price, so we can try and take this sucker off the market really soon. So hopefully I'll have a permanent street address within not too long.
Very nice. Exciting. Congratulations. Well, folks, we also have to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin as well. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming week, and where can people find you and all of your work?
Well, I'm doing some research right now on dashboards. I'm also working on a taxonomy of vulnerability management products, which is more exciting than I can, you know, easily describe. It's good work. I'm enjoying the research. And you know what? I would really love to hear from members of the Twyatt Riot about what you think you'd like to see reports on. What would you like to see research-based take on in from the technology standpoint? You can always DM me on Twitter. I'm KG4GWA. Send a note to the twyatt@twit.tv. And I will try to get you back there. Let me know. Always want to hear what your ideas are, because I value the expertise and input of the Twyatt Riot.
Thank you, Curtis. We do indeed. Because we also want to thank you as well, because you're that person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our show and get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise news. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the co-host information, show notes, info about the guests, and the stories we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful download and subscribe links. That's right. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, and listen on any one of your devices, on any one of your podcast applications, because we're on all of them. And it's really the best way to stay on top of your news as well as support the show. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family members, and your coworkers. Give them the gift of Twyatt, because we talk a lot about a lot of fun topics here on the show. It's a lot of tech topics, and we definitely feel that they would find it fun and interesting as well. Now, you can always follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my latest and greatest ways that you can customize your office experience and make it easier for you and more productive for you and your organization. Now, after you subscribe, remember, we are available 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays. We do this show live every week, live.twit.tv. You can come see how the pizza is made. You can come see how the show is run, all the behind the scenes, all the fun stuff. Definitely check out live.twit.tv. Now, of course, also, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room live as well. We have a lot of great characters in there, some really great discussions we had in there today. Thank you for everyone who's in there. You can check that out at irc.com. twit.tv. We love the chat room. We have great discussions. We definitely want you to be in there as well if you're going to watch the show live. Now, if you can't watch the show live but still want to be part of the amazing community, like I mentioned before, come join the 24/7 discussion that happens all the time here at on the twit.community website. It's a great website out there. All the hosts are out there. We talk a lot about all the shows that happen. We also talk sometimes about the guests, and guests get in there and also get involved and have a great discussion. We have a lot of great discussions about tech as well. So check that out, twit.community 24/7. Of course, I want to thank everyone who makes the show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week to do This Week in Enterprise Tech, and we couldn't do it without them. So thank you to all their support. I also want to thank all the staff and engineers at Twit. And of course, I want to thank Mr. Brian Chee one more time, because he's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. He does all the bookings and the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do the show without him. So thanks, Dan Chiebert, for all your support. I also want to thank Mr. Victor. He's our editor for the show. He makes us look good, and he's going to make this show smooth as butter for your ears. And of course, before we sign out, I also thank our TD for today, Mr. Ant Pruitt. Ant is a busy guy. He does tons of stuff on Twit. Ant, what's going on for you in the coming weeks and over there at Twit?
Still doing a lot of fun conversations with my photography friends. It might help if I turn the mic on. I swear. You'd think I'd done this before, right? But no, make sure you're checking out Hands on Photography, twit.tv. This week I got to talk with Mr. Alan Hess, and just look at that photo. Oh my goodness. Good stuff.
Thank you, Ann. Yeah, really great stuff. I'd definitely check that show out for sure. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
We do appreciate you watching this show right here on the Twit Network. If you want to make sure you are up to date on all things iOS, tvOS, watchOS, HomePod OS, all the OSs from Apple, you've got to check out iOS Today. Rosemary Orchard, the incredible Rosemary Orchard, and myself talk each week about the news for iOS, the best apps and games, and so much more. You've got to check out the show, and we do appreciate you for subscribing. Thank you.